Welcome, everybody, to the When Hard Work Beats Talent podcast. We are super excited to actually have an insurance guy on here. Not like last time where we kind of had an insurance guy, but he's more of a business-minded guy. I don't know. It's harder to describe Ryan Hanley, but he is. I met him in insurance, but we actually have an insurance guy. You know, 11, 12 episodes in, whatever it is. Insurance. All things insurance today. But not all things, because insurance is still a little boring. However, we have Chris Meredith, who is running for the insurance commissioner in the great state of Oklahoma, which is still on top of Texas West. Just letting you know, it is geographically, Oklahoma is on top of Texas. So it is not a lie. No matter what happened this past weekend in Dallas or in Stillwater, it's still on top. So, with that said, Chris Meredith, who also has a cool story I was reading prior to OU Texas, that he worked his tail off to go back and get back in shape to get go on the OU team, football team. He's a former OU football player, too. Yeah. So with that said, Chris Meredith, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Happy to be here and ready to get started talking about the OU thing, because I got some really neat insights.
Nice. Perfect. Well, let's start. We'll start on rapid fire questions. Then the first question out of that will be, tell us about OU.
Yeah. Oh, man. It was my dream to play at Oklahoma as a kid growing up. My dad played there. My grandma used to take me to all the games. I mean, I went to Switzer's house. It was the dream. I used to lay in the floor listening to the band. You know, she had an 8-track. And I'd listen to that band play, and man, I would get fired up, go outside and play, you know, in the front yard or whatever. But, you know, you mentioned the post. So I posted, you know, the OU Texas game is special to me for a variety of reasons. But one of it just on top of just the season, OU Texas reminds me of kind of my journey. Like I got there in 93 out of high school. I was a blue chip, you know, highly talented player, but I had some problems at the end of my high school career. And they just carried over into that my first year of college. Ended up leaving, just left football, left the program, just wanted to hang out and have fun. And after a little bit of time, I worked at General Motors for a minute in between, and hanging out with older people, I learned, you know, just what a big mistake it was. And I had to go chase after what I was meant to be and what I was meant to do. So I moved out, got an apartment. I was by myself. I wanted no distractions because I had to get away from, you know, certain people, certain things. And all I did was work out, and go to school. And I had my first transcript. My first year was all F's and like one W. It was really bad. So I had to go fix that. And which is funny because I got into my first career, my first job of lobbying, because I hunted Merv Johnson down at a basketball game. And I said, hey, look, I fixed my grades. I showed him my transcript. He could see I was in shape. And I was just like, hey, I just need another chance, you know, on this. And, you know, he helped me get back on the team that first year in 96 with John Blake. And that kind of kicked me out. I crawled out of a hole, and that kind of got some new footing and helped me, kind of go from there and start the journey.
What position were you?
Offensive tackle.
Left side or right side?
Right side. We flipped lines at the time, I think. Flip sides. Sorry. I was always with the tight end side.
Okay. We know a strong side, huh?
Yeah. Strong side.
All right.
We'll probably get back into some OU football later, but what is one hidden talent that you have?
Hidden talents.
Ooh.
That's pretty interesting. I have to think about that one. Hidden talent. I think probably one hidden talent you don't see. My dad had a restaurant when I was growing up, and it was a pizza parlor, and I could make 50 pizzas in 20 minutes. And I could put the sauce. We had two, you'd get two pies, right? You get the dough, and you put them down, and then you'd have to sauce them, put the cheese on, put on the ingredients. I could do them both at the same time with left and right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you had to, It was hard because we were trying to open the restaurant, and that would take up a good 30, 45 minutes, an hour maybe for some people to get all the pizzas made. We'd have to make 40, 50 of them for the, you know, that shift. So I had to figure out, how do I get faster? I just kept thinking, how do I get faster? I was like, well, maybe I could try doing both hands. And it was really sloppy at first, but I kept practicing because I was like, if I could figure this out, I can double my speed and get done with this. And then kind of, you know, so I was just always thinking that way. And that was kind of my first experience. But so, yeah, being able to make pizza very fast. The second part of that is I can also cut one fast. We had like a giant butcher sword. We didn't have like the little roller thing. We used to chop it like this. I could knock one of those out in, you know, seconds, you know, without cutting my finger off. So, yeah.
Which is good because those things don't grow back.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
No. Where is one place you've been that you don't want to go back to?
Well, I always think about the environments I'm in. And, you know, when you say that, Seattle pops in my head.
Okay.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. I mean, I used to go up there a lot for work in my prior job. And I really enjoyed part of that trip was going from Seattle to Portland, driving down. But going into Seattle was always not my favorite. It was every time it was raining, just like you know, kind of like the, you know, you assume it's gray, rainy, and it just was not it just seemed very sad, like a sad place, you know, yeah. To me, every time I went, and I went there multiple times, I kept thinking, well, maybe it's just an accident, but because I'm pretty easy going, I like going places, like traveling, but that just, it always gave me this feeling of just melancholy. No, I never liked that. So it's not on my radar to go back on my own at any time.
What's wrong with that? I like the sunshine myself.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. What is your guilty pleasure?
Well, first thing that pops in my head is, you know, probably beer. I love beer. I love all kinds of beer. Oktoberfest is here. That gets me pumped up, excited. I always wanted to go to Germany for the real one. We've got a really good one here in Tulsa that I've been to a couple times. And I've been out to the one in Choctaw. And I just enjoy it. Problem with it is it doesn't – it collides with my diet and my nutrition goals for life. So I can't really indulge too often. I mean, and it just – beer is high calorie and it just sticks with you. So I try to stay away from it as much as possible.
Keep on the ribs, that's for sure.
Oh, man, it blows you up. It blows me up anyway. Yeah, it's bad.
What's your go-to beer?
Ooh, well, I mean, right now it's Oktoberfest. Sam Adams Oktoberfest is, when I see that come out, I get super hyped up, but I never buy it. Because I'm like, hold out, just next time. Don't need it this time. You know, and I'm just sitting there looking at it like.
You turn around and you're like, can't do it.
It's calling me. It's just like, I'm like, okay, but then, you know, but. Every once in a while, I'll sneak one, and you know, but I try not to buy them and bring them home. I'll just, you know, if I'm out having dinner or something, I'll have one and enjoy it and move about.
Right, makes sense.
But hey, the F5 from Coop, Oklahoma brewed. That is a really good beer to me. I love that beer.
Too dark for me.
It's the grapefruit one. It's a light, but it is like a. I don't know, 7% beer. It's a pretty strong IPA, but yeah, I enjoy that one.
I bet we have one of our buddies that probably knows a little bit about that. He knows all about.
Stuart Vrong. Have you met Stuart Vrong yet?
I don't think so.
He's really good guy. He is a very intelligent man. I mean, I hate the fact that I'm saying this and we're recording it right now because we're friends and I don't like to be nice to my friends.
Edit that out. Yeah,
I have to totally edit that out. I doubt he listens anyway because that's how kind of friends we are. So I don't have to worry about him hearing
us. There's zero chance. My wife doesn't even listen to us. So there's zero chance Stuart's listening.
So funny.
Yeah. So who is a person that has a surprising impact on your life?
Surprising impact?
Mm-hmm.
Man. I think Mike, you know, I don't know if we think about, I mean, I don't know if it's surprising necessarily, but maybe the way I think about it is surprising. But I mean, my kids, you know, you think about raising kids, you're thinking about what you're going to pour into them. You think about, you know, what you're going to do for them and how you're going to make them better and make them into, you know, productive citizens and have a great life and be successful. But what they do to me on the reverse side has been surprisingly, I mean, impactful. I mean, they drive me, they encourage me without even saying anything, just being there, you know, and they create this willpower in me to do things. I mean, like part of the running for office, there's a lot of reasons why I'm doing it, but there's a big piece of it is I want to show them that, hey, if you want something, you can go do it. You can go make it happen. It's just up to you to go and put your foot forward and go do it and make the world you want to make. And, you know, those are things that, you know, it's been, I guess I've kind of known it for a little while, ever since my first was born. I mean, it just changed me in it. But, you know, that feedback loop of, you know, what they give, how they're making me a better man, better husband. I mean, I don't know that I expected as much an impact as it has been. So it's been a surprisingly impactful.
Yes.
Kids do have a way of pushing you outside your comfort zone.
I really did.
All the time.
Kids
That's why I
definitely.
stay away from Oktoberfest. I can't drink. I'm like, no beer because I don't want the kids to see me drinking all the
It's funny what kids will do for you.
Yeah, I mean, you want to set a good example, right? I mean, that's what pushes me down the road.
Yep. What is the hardest thing you've had to overcome?
I think cutting certain people off has been pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know, I can go back to that when I decided to go back and play. I mean, I had to really change everything I was doing. I mean, I was smoking, I was drinking, hanging out with people that liked to party. They weren't horrible people. They just, you know, they liked different things, and you can't achieve, you know, physical levels that you need to play a Division One program doing those types of things. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, I'm sure some people do it, but I don't. I'm not Dennis Rodman, you know. But
Yeah.
I mean, I just had to get away from that, and you know, I had to stop. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to hate them. It doesn't mean you have to stop talking to them. But you can't be around people that are going to take you off path of where you're trying to go, and you know, and cutting relationships. Connections that you've had can be very difficult. To me, that was very hard because in some ways I'm a people person. I mean, that's what I do is connect with people. I love it. I've never met anyone. The only friends I don't have are the ones I haven't met yet. I mean, that's kind of how I am. And we went through this Strength Finder assessment last week at my job. And no, surprisingly, that's kind of what came out was, you know, you're all about connecting with people and just hearing their story and, you know, telling your story. And the dark side of that is you want everyone to like you, so you become a people pleaser. So I've also had to balance that out over the years through development of, you know, setting my boundaries and knowing when to say no and those types of things. So, and that's, you know, early on, it was extremely hard. I actually don't know how I did it. I mean, I kind of give credit to God for leading me, because a lot of times I look back and I'm like, that was not me. I mean, where did that come from? Where did this discipline and this ability, these things that are not you normally, where did they come from? And you know, I think God had a big hand in that, just kind of helping me down the road.
Great. Well, the last one for us is if you had one last meal and you can eat it with anybody, dead or alive, who is it and what meal is it?
Okay. Well, you know this is going to be cheesy, right?
It's fine. We don't care.
Okay.
Well,
Well,
if you ever meet us in person, you'll realize we're super cheesy. So it's good.
Okay. Well, I'm having breakfast for dinner.
Okay.
So
Yes.
like I need like probably pancakes, gotta have bacon, eggs, hash browns, that type of meal, and I'm having it with my wife.
There you go. Nothing wrong with that.
There's no one else I'd rather spend my last day with. What's that?
How do you do those eggs? Are you an over easy, let it run out? Are you a scrambled guy?
Oh, scrambled, definitely.
You do scrambled.
I love scrambled.
We do it both ways here. We have kids that like it both ways. So we have over easy, we have scrambled, we have hard. We do it all kinds of ways here in our house. We go through way too many eggs. I need to have chickens is what I need.
Yeah, we got chickens.
That's funny. You just stirred a memory from Seattle in my head. You remember a show called Man vs. Food?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so when I was doing all this traveling, I decided, well, I'm just going to go eat where he ate. And one of the places was in Seattle, and they had a 16-egg omelet.
Oh.
Pound of cheese, pound of chili.
That's a lot.
I ate it.
You ate the whole thing?
Yeah. And then I started my drive to Portland, and it got not good.
I was in a hurry, huh?
Stomach was not happy.
Yeah. He went down to San Antonio and did one at a place called Lulu's, and they have a chicken fried steak that's about this big. I mean, it's just massive, and they have a cinnamon roll. I think it's like three sticks of butter are in it. So when I moved up here from San Antonio 9 years ago, and we had a staff meeting, and so I ordered one to the office, and there were eight of us in the office at the time. It took us a week to go through it. Eight people. Yeah, it took us a week to go, like 5 days, like a Monday through Friday to go through that stupid cinnamon roll. And I was so tired of cinnamon rolls when it was over with, but it was so good every time you put it in your mouth because it's just straight butter and sugar. And what Southerner doesn't love butter and sugar? And so it's good stuff.
Yeah, this is true. So tell us about you. Tell us about your decision to run for insurance commissioner. Who helped you? Decide, yeah, let's do this. Let's go for this. What were those conversations like?
Yeah, it's you know, it's a culmination of a lot of decisions, little decisions put together, and that's often how your life works, right? And I like to talk about kind of the first time I decided to, like, you see something's wrong, you need to go speak up, you need to go try to fix it. Don't just sit here and wait for someone else to go do it. Mm-hmm. And you know, when I first started, I worked for Farmers Insurance. I've worked there 20 plus years. I started as an adjuster, which is funny because my agent got me there because I was tired of being broke. I was studying bioterrorism at the University of Oklahoma for my master's because my degree is in biology. It has nothing to do with insurance. Yeah. I never expected to be insurance at all.
None of us do.
Yeah, I've not met anyone yet. Well, I have actually now. I've met a few, but they're very rare. So one of my jobs, I was a supervisor and I was helping a lady with her total loss. She totaled her car and we're trying to get her fixed up. She's a single mom, four kids. And I'm telling her the paperwork process. We're going to mail you this paperwork. I want you to sign it, get it notarized, mail it back, and then we'll mail you a check. And she's just sitting here like, how long is this going to take? You know, how am I supposed to do this? I don't have a car. And I'm just sitting there like, man, this is just, it doesn't make any sense. You know, I'm using email. We're using computers. Why do I got to mail all this stuff? Why do we got to have a notary? And I went to my boss and I was like, why do we got to have all this stuff? And they, you know, they explained the law and all this stuff. Like, why don't we just change it? You know, just kind of like, never thought about that. Why don't we just change it? You know, why not? And so that started me down this road of, well, you know, I ended up connecting with our government affairs group and we wrote some laws that, well, we didn't write them. We got the legislature to write them. And then, you know, I had to register as a lobbyist because anytime you go to the Capitol and you try to advocate for or against a bill, you're supposed to be registered no matter what. So that's what we were doing was, you know, advocating for this change. Hey, we don't want notaries. I want to be able to send this with electronic signature and I want to be able to pay through electronic payment, which was illegal up until 2013 because they wanted you to do check or cash. I mean, they were kind of looking the other way at it, I think, but, you know, it wasn't in the law that this is okay. It was just antiquated. So we got the law, you know, we got it through the House, we got it through the Senate, we got it passed, governor signed it. And that was kind of one of my first forays into this. Hey, let's just change, you know, be the change. You know, you hear that all the time, but what does that mean? And so fast forward to today, it's just kind of that same, you know, take that with what I'm trying to show my kids that you can make whatever you want. Take that with dropping out of college my first year and looking back and going, I need to get back into it. No regrets, right? Because that's a part of it too, is me going back and going, I need to do this. Because if I look back 20 years from now, I'm going to wish I at least tried and gave my best. And so it's ultimately a combination of all that. It's you know, it's a no regrets, you know, let's burn the ships and go after what we want. Let's show her, you know, let's show that this can be done. It's not just my kids. I want everyone to know this. You can change stuff. You can step up and change the world. You don't have to sit around and wait for someone else to do it. You know, for me, I look back, I look at, you know, from my job, I see a, from a national perspective. I see all, you know, what all the states are doing, all their struggles. And I'm just sitting here like, I know what Oklahoma needs to do. It's just going to, it's a matter of getting it done. And there's a lot of, you know, the politics get in the way of true change. And we know what needs to be done. And they, sometimes they just can't do it because of this group wants that or that group wants this. And in my head, I'm like, well, I'm not a politician. I'm just a problem solver. I'm a business guy, private sector, and I don't have any of those entanglements. And what I'm going to do is the same thing I've done the last 10 years from a government affairs perspective is grassroots engagement. That's what delivers your change. I mean, you get enough people telling their elected officials that they want the stuff changed. It ain't going to matter what the special interests want. Okay. You know, but you know, my preferred method is getting everyone at the table, making it a win-win. I want, you know, the things I want to do, like fortified homes, to build better homes that can withstand the hail and the wind. It's already been done in Alabama. We just need to do it here, and we just need to do it faster. We're going to learn from them. We've got things in place that are going, but it shouldn't take, you know, years. There's other things that can be done. I've seen in other places that we can do here and copy and just implement it if we have the willpower to do it. And you know, to me, it's all about getting everyone on board. So, you know, when I'm going out campaigning, it's not just vote for me. It's hey, join the team and we're going to do these changes and I'm going to need you to be a part of it. And if you want, you know, you're like for an agent, their customers are coming in yelling at them about the rates. I can't do anything about the rates. Well, actually you can. You can vote to change the system. And that's what I represent.
So how do you change the rates for, let's say, property insurance? Because we all know homeowners insurance is crazy high. There was a long time ago, a couple of years ago, I had a buddy send me a referral from Georgia. So they were moving from Georgia to Oklahoma. Well, in Georgia, they're paying pennies for their homeowner's premium compared to what we pay. They buy just a regular old house, $300,000-$400,000 house, right? Compared to what they had there in Oklahoma. Well, it was three times the amount of money for premium. He's like, I'm not going to do this. I'm like, sorry, dude, that's what I got. How do you, is that a insurance law deal? Is that a working with the carriers to change the rates? Because at some point, there's so much hail or tornadoes in Oklahoma, it makes sense that they have higher rates because they're fixing stuff all the time. That's right. But how do you work in the middle and have a good compromise on that?
Yeah. So, you know, what I always tell people is we're always going to have higher rates because of that weather. The risk is super high here. That's the bottom line. Tornadoes, wind, hail, ice, earthquakes. We've got all kinds of stuff. So then you step back and go, you know, this is just a principle, right? Is you work with what you can. Mm-hmm. You start where you're at. And I say, well, I can't change the weather. So that's out. So what can we change? And so you look at all the, you know, I always tell people about coffee, right? You got this cup of coffee and, you know, the price of the coffee you buy, it's all from the input costs, right? You've got all these costs that go in, you know, the price of the coffee, the price of the cup, the price of the lid, the price of the employees, the price of the building they're selling it from. Just start looking at all that. And for me, so for insurance, I'm thinking about how do you reduce cost and how do you reduce risk, which is just future cost, right?
Right.
You can go into, you know, roofing and hail is probably the, you know, the primary driver. So that's where you want to target first. And, you know, to reduce costs, you got to think outside the box. I mean, we've got a massive amount of fraud going on And we've got a system set up where fraud's not really being prosecuted. Mm-hmm. I mean, the insurance department has a fraud unit, but they really only go after fraud committed by insurance professionals, like, you know, an adjuster or an agent. The person who's actually burning down their house on purpose, that's for the attorney general's office. And they got a lot of things going on, apparently, because I've always been told that they don't do anything. And that's not just our current one. That's the previous and the previous and the previous. It's just it's a resource issue. It's not they're bad. They're not doing their job. It's just their resources are stretched. There's only so much they can do. So I'm like, give it to me. Give it to the commissioner. We have a fraud unit, experts in insurance fraud. So why aren't we doing that job? Maybe that's not the answer. Maybe it's better to just work with the new AG who's coming in and try to build that up and where we can go after it. I'm just saying this is the kind of brainstorm and think differently. Politically, you don't talk about taking over a department's job or work or whatever. That's just crazy, right? You know, another one is roofing. Who's policing the roofing business? From my roofing friends, they're telling me no one. People are getting away with all kinds of stuff. So, you know, and they're not building to code. They're building shoddy work. They're coming in from out of state, lying to people about their contracts. They say, hey, sign this so I can get on your roof and check it. Oh, that was actually a contract for work. Now, there's just all kinds of stuff going on, and that needs to be addressed. And that can be, you know, I'm working with the Roofing Association to try to, so they can kind of clean up their own industry. But there needs to be a partnership there, you know, from us. Again, this is how I'm thinking. I'm like, anything that's touching cost of insurance, I'm going to touch. I'm going to be involved in. It doesn't necessarily have to be a law change. It could just be conversation. It could be just bringing them into the loop, getting together and talking about it. Insurance companies and roofing companies, we need to have, I mean, we don't need, maybe we don't need laws. Maybe we just need a compact, an agreement, a standard agreement that's like standardizes the work a little bit. Maybe I've talked to a couple of other commissioners about forming a co-op where we all together buy the materials and at a cheaper cost. So we lower the price there. Because if you look at consumer price index, all the things that cost to rebuild a house are sky. They're just enormous. They're astronomically high from inflation. So that's why we're having all this higher cost of insurance, because the cost to rebuild has exploded. You know, just a variety. There's a variety of ideas. And a lot of it I've come up with just from observing. I mean, this is what other places are doing, things like this. You know, the risk side of it, bring down the risks. You start building better, we start building roofs that can withstand these storms, then you're going to have lower premiums there. And, you know, we just need to build better homes. I mean, we're building homes and roofs that are disposable versus, you know, Alabama's got the fortified program. They've got 70,000 homes that are fortified. Hurricane Sally hit it. They did a full study on it. And it was, I can't remember the exact data, but if the homes that were hit were fortified, based on the existing fortified and non-fortified volume, they would have reduced claims by like 67%. Deductibles same somewhere around that same area because it can withstand Category 2 hurricanes. So you have lower claims, you have lower damage, you have lower premiums. So just those are, you know, there's a variety of things that you can do if the willpower is there, you know, and it's just, and that's kind of, for me, you know, this whole race is, I'm focused on that issue because that's what everyone cares about. I care about it. And it's a pillar of the economy. You lose insurance, you don't have mortgages, you don't have real estate, you have a serious problem. So that is absolutely where I'm focused at.
Has there been any discussions at all with the state minimum limits for the auto liability? Because that's one piece to where I think at one point I was told that we were one of the higher states with the state minimum at 2550, but I still think that's way too low. I personally think it should be at minimum 5100 and even more the 100, 300, because if you look at the premiums between 2550 and 100, 300, it's not that much. It's your Starbucks. It's three Starbucks for a week difference a month. And you have better limits.
Yeah.
So has there been any discussions about raising the state minimum limits?
There's been a bill, a few bills out there for that. And a lot of discussion is number one, you can always buy more, right? And it's up to, a lot of agents I talk to, they're just like, I don't even sell the minimums. If you want minimum, don't come to me. You know, go somewhere else, because I'm not selling you that. That's not worth, it's not the right thing to do. And then the other side of it is, if you raise the limits, we already have an uninsured motorist problem. And my research is telling me it is because of the cost. And so if you raise that up, even if it's small, it's debatable, right? This is just discussion. But, there's concern that the UM rate goes up if you raise the minimum too much. Maybe you just raise it up in stages. I don't know the answer to that. There's also some discussion about, this is like when I first started driving, I was so upset that I had to buy insurance. Like, why are you making me do this? You're making me do it. I don't like to be made to do anything by the government. You know where we live. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. And I've always asked the question of, why do we have it? Why is it mandatory? And I've never gotten very far with it. I just kind of let it go, but it's theoretical. There's a lot of discussion there about what to do and with it. I think it's up to us as professionals to make sure people are educated. Mm-hmm. If we just, if we kind of lean on the, this is required by law and make people get it, you're missing the why. Right. People need to understand. This is the biggest problem with insurance, in my opinion. People are not being educated. Some of our agents are just, they're selling. They're just selling. They're not explaining what does this do? What is the importance of it? Why do you need higher limits? And, once they're explained to it, they usually, they're much more apt to buying the right mm-hmm. amount versus, trying to meet a law.
You show them, hey, if you buy this policy, it's $100 and $300. But if you look at the cost associated, break it down between that versus $250, $500, and you get an umbrella to provide more, liability protection on you, and it's only X amount of money per month difference, then they see it and they're like, oh, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. Then you protect them better. And it's mind-boggling that agents don't do that. More of that.
On what Chris was just saying about the education piece. When you educate a person, they become a more informed buyer. When they become a more informed buyer, they make a better decision in their with their purchasing dollars instead of just making a reactionary purchase, which mm-hmm. is a lot of. And again, we work in an industry where if you look at the bell curve, most of the agents that work in the bell curve are in that two standard deviations from the middle, right? They're good people. They do a good job. You have some really, really good ones that are the outliers who do just a phenomenal job. You guys, you work with some of those agents at your office there, Ryan. I mean, I would include you and Stuart in that list as well. And then you have some bad characters, right? Who are just trying to, here's sign this so I can help you. And it's an AOR. They're not explaining anything to the insurer. They're just trying to get another $100,000 deal on the books and move on to the next deal. And then they can't get a hold of their agent, 6 months from then when they have a question. So, it kind of hammers home to what Chris was saying right there. Education is such a key component of what we do as in an industry, because if you explain it to them, it makes a lot more sense to them, because now they understand where you're coming from. You're not just trying to sell a premium dollar. You're trying to sell a peace of mind and a safety net to protect their business as a whole.
I love that. That kind of brings me to a third. If I have three pillars, it's reduce cost, reduce risk, and rebuild trust. I saw a survey that was done. I don't remember who did it, but it basically said 90% of people in Oklahoma hate their insurance company. And it just it breaks my heart because number one, I know we're better than that. And, insurance used to kind of be this, I'll pay it and then forget about it. And then they, when they need it, they're taken care of. And most of the time that's still the case. For whatever reason, media, PR, actual things that are going on, I don't know, but they've gotten to this, the survey says people hate their insurance company. And I'm like, that's because I can tell you right now, I was on the ground in Moore tornado in 2013, the day after, And I was like, this is what insurance is about. Because we were in there helping people. I mean, getting them water, getting them food, getting them shelter, getting them new clothes. People that had just lost everything. And we had paid, I think, 90% of the claims within 6 days. And we're ready to roll out. I mean, I was just like, this is what it's all about. I mean, this is really why I love insurance. That type of thing right there. And to see it go from that to where we are now, where there's all this distrust and allegations and things, you know, it bothers me. So that's why the trust and transparency is a big piece of what I want to do. And, you know, I don't know where that leads to. We just need to get better. You know, I think the education piece is big. Talking direct, you know, department encouraging our agents to do a better job of educating the average Oklahoman on insurance. And that's something we need to do as a department, is get out in the field and really not just tell them this is what the department does, but tell them, here's how insurance works, especially with home and auto.
Yes. Big job. Coming from the direct side, I call it the direct rider side because it's farmers and it's the direct rider side. But anyways, come from there, what was the game plan or mindset to work and at least introduce yourself to us independent agents?
As far as like for myself?
Yes, for yourself, for your campaign. How has it been working with the independent side versus a direct side?
You know, it's interesting because we all share almost the same problems. I mean, everyone, you know, you have a very different structure in the way things operate, but you also have the same problems. You have a soaring cost that's going into the product that you're trying to sell, you know, the average Oklahoman who can't take it anymore. And it's worse that it's not just a higher price, it's a higher piece of the wallet. And so, you come down to, there's so many people that are, you know, they're hurting from that. And you guys feel it just like, you know, the captive agent side does. Except usually the captive agents, they don't have as many alternatives, you know, and they're kind of stuck in the middle. So, you know, the independent side, it seems like there's more options. So you have a little bit less pressure, maybe from what I'm hearing. And you've also got, most of the time you're more multidisciplined, a little more commercial and other things, rather than, you know, your typical average captive agent. But yep. You know, the things that impact us, they impact us all. I mean, the things that are feeding into the system, whether it's, you know, it's fraud, it's litigation abuse. You know, those are the things I want to look at is, you know, I looked at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce pegged Oklahoma at about $2,000 from tort abuse per family in Oklahoma. National Insurance Crime Bureau says it's about $1,000, it's 800 to 1,000 per family because of fraud, increased cost. So those things, you know, those are going to feed into everybody's product. It doesn't matter if you're independent or captured or captive.
That is wild.
How would you drive down? I mean, what can be done? Because that's a big number. If it's, you said 800, you said 2,000 average for Oklahoma, 800 everywhere else. That's $1,200 per family in the state of Oklahoma. We're paying on top of what the national average is.
It's 2,000 for litigation abuse, and then another 800 for fraud.
So it's $2,800.
Yeah,
almost $3,000 per family. That is real money. Yeah. That is. So what can be done from that standpoint? I mean, you're talking not to spend more money because I mean you're going to have to spend more money to kind of combat this abuse. But this fraud and abuse that's going on. What are some small things that you can do to help drive those costs down, which in turn puts more money back in the pocket of the consumer?
Yeah, I mean. I don't know. No, there's some reforms we need to look at from Louisiana and Florida. You know, Florida put in some place some caps on like fees and things like that You know, they and it helped curb lawsuits. That drove down insurance prices. They went negative for the first time in a long time, along with, you know, their fortified program. But, yeah, they did some litigation reform in Florida. We need to look at, see what's missing. And then Louisiana did a similar thing, and that also helped, is helping them kind of get back on track. So, you know, those need to be looked at. Things that happen there may not apply here. So, you know, I've worked with the state chamber on researching exactly what needs to happen in that realm. But we've done a few things that will help in the last year. but I don't know. We don't know if they're exact for Oklahoma. Like I've heard, like the assignment of benefits bill was passed last year that banned like a roofing company from being able to step in and take benefits and directly engage with the insurance company and then have lawsuit, be able to file lawsuits. I've been told it's not a problem. At least it wasn't. And, you know, this is good. It's still good because you want to prevent it from coming, because what they'll do is they'll do something in Florida. Oh, I can't do it in Florida. Well, can we do it in Oklahoma? You know, that's what happens. And it just comes across the country. So I think it's still good to have, but, you know, we need to look real closely with real data and figure out exactly what is driving it. I mean, I can tell you right now, Discovery, I was chairman of the legislative committee at the state chamber for a few years, and we worked on some reforms, and you know, a big one was Discovery, because what happens is attorneys will pull millions of dollars in Discovery, and it costs, and it just runs up the price of everything. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what business you're in, the lawsuit industry just pushes that number up. I mean, I've heard incredible tens of millions of dollars in Discovery. So it's kind of, you know, there's some Discovery things you can do. There's some Apex doctrine. A lot of times they'll put the CEO on the lawsuit to force a settlement or whatever when they have nothing to do with it. Like, what does the CEO have to do with a tornado claim or something? So it's kind of, you know, there's lots of things there. You know, you got to look at the data and figure out exactly what's driving it, that cost up. But there's, you know, look at any billboard.
It's not free. And there's a reason why they have so many of them. They make good money when they
and make no mistake.
Have to go
I
to trial
in our
or
civil justice system.
Start doing
there's some
legal work.
It's a remedy for a lot of people, and that is legitimate. And I don't have a problem with any of that. It's the ones that are just using it to take our premium, filter it through the insurance company, and put it in their pocket, you know, just as a game or something. And I don't, you know, our justice system should not be abused. It should be, you know, honored by people who are actually doing good work.
I think the state's done a good job over the last, I don't remember when they did the work comp reform, but the work comp market here in the state of Oklahoma is the testament to legislators and the OID and insurance agents alike, whether it be captive or independent, who came together to reform that program to make it what it is. And now it's one of the ones that's sought after across the country. We have companies flocking into the state to write business because they know they can do it and make money. And we're seeing decreasing premiums every year on every account. Well, for the most part, there are certain, I mean, obviously outliers, but for the most part, the premiums are going down because it's such a competitive market.
Absolutely.
And there's no reason it can't be in other lines as well.
Talk about, we're about halfway in, a little bit more. At this time, we always like to just ask, you know, our podcast is called When Hard Work Beats Talent. You know, you were in athletics. We all were. And you always see that one person, that one guy or gal that said, and you say, no, if that individual worked, had the work ethic to meet their talent, they'd be unstoppable. True in business, true in life, true in everything. What is your one story where you're like, oh man, if that person worked hard, you know, they would be unstoppable on the field or in life or in business.
I mean, I have to go back.
What's that story for you?
You know, the comeback story. I mean, that's where I've learned it, right? I mean, and I, just to set the table, I mean, I was working 40 hours a week, double shifts sometimes. I was going to Rose State College, 12-hour, 16-hour regular schedule. And then I would be in the gym or running, for 3 hours. And I set that up on purpose. I mean, I was just like, this is what I'm going to do. And I remember my car broke down and my dad was giving me a ride home. And we drove by this old, it was a shopping mall, old shopping mall. And there was a bunch of people. It was like 10, 11 o'clock at night. There were a bunch of people and they were in there playing like, I don't know if it was like Dungeons and Dragons or something, some kind of game deal. And I mean, at the time I kind of had like a resentment attitude towards it. It was like, they could be doing something productive versus playing around. I just wanted to be playing around. I mean, being honest, but at the same time, I was like, if you devote your attention to what you're trying to get to, all of it, how can you not win? I mean, or at least set yourself up where I can go back and go, you know what? I did everything I could. I gave everything I had, and that's kind of where this attitude developed from. So I was like, I wanted to go to bed every night tired. I wanted to go to bed exhausted, knowing I gave everything I had. And the next day I'd get up and do it again. The next day, do it again. Next day, do it again. I mean, I remember specifically one time it was December. I think it was New Year's Eve, and it was ice on the ground. And I'm in Del City, Oklahoma, Southeast 44th Street, over by the Tinker Air Force Base. And that was a road you took to go to this club that I used to go to on Grand. And my friend, I was out running, sweater on, it was freezing cold, hard to run because it was so icy and snowy and whatever. But I was running down 44th, midnight. And my friends were driving by honking at me, laughing, making fun of me. They thought what I was doing was stupid. And there was no way I would do it. But that just, I mean, that empowered me. I was just like, I always wanted to be just different. I didn't want to be like everybody else. And I remember one of my friends had told me, I told him, I'm going back to Oklahoma. I'm going back to play football after being out a year or whatever it was. And he's like, man, you ain't gonna do shit. And I was like, man, I mean, it hit so hard, and I cursed on purpose because I want you to feel it. And I felt that, man. And I used to think about that every day when I would go out and work out. It was echoing in the back of my head of what he said. And I was just like, I'm going to prove him wrong. And I'm just going to outwork him. And I'm going to come out of nowhere and do this. And, it didn't quite work out the way I wanted. I got back on the team. It worked out good. I never played. Just for whatever reason, I mean, that would have been, there was a 3 year gap between the last time I put on pads. So it took some adjustment that I probably didn't realize. And then D1, I'd lost those years I was out. You don't get them back. Once you step on the field, the clock's going, even if you're working at General Motors or whatever. And so I decided to go D2. Okay. Two, I went to Northeastern State University and, I was kind of the old guy on the team, but, we ended up, I ended up starting offensive tackle for 3 years. We went to the Final Four, won a big ring, regional championship, conference championship ring. I was offensive lineman of the year. I mean, it was great. And, I didn't, that was not on my bingo card, but that's where I ended
That's
up.
awesome.
And, you don't, and it just kind of goes from there. And that was all about hard work. I mean, it was just about getting up and doing things. I mean, I saw that all the time. I mean, with the people around me, especially the people that were down and given up on, this is how you make the difference. This is how you make up the gap, is going out and just outworking people. And I can tell you right now, I mean, in politics side, not to be long-winded, but in politics side, the first time I saw that, our Senator Adam Pugh in my district, he comes out of nowhere, freshman guy. He's not elected. He's not expected to win. He's up against this guy who's been on like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and an NFL player. But man, every day that guy was out hitting the door. He'd get off work, 5 o'clock. I mean, there's sometimes I drove him around and I volunteered to do that. But he would knock doors from 5 to 9 every day for like 2 years. Every day. I mean, he would go through shoes like
Oh,
every
wow.
3 months. It was crazy. He hit every door, I bet, 7 times, and he won. He won by outworking his opponent, who had way more money, way more name recognition, all that stuff. But he just hit those doors, and I just always remember that. No, it was...
did he beat Steve Largent?
I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a... I don't remember his name. He'll hit me in a minute.
Mm-hmm. So I remember at one point Steve Largent was over in the Tulsa area. Anyways. Oh, yeah. That's pretty awesome. So do you take that same mindset into what you're doing now and running?
I almost like it. I mean, I want to go out and, you know, the agent is absolutely like my core. Like if I'm thinking about a base, it's the agent. Who cares more about the insurance commissioner race than the agent? And who is better to advise their clients on who you should vote for? And so I'm going to go out, and it's so much more. I mean, I just love doing it. I mean, that's the other piece to it. I mean, this is, I love doing it. I love going out to Lawton and, or Guymon. I've been out to Guymon and talked to the agents out there, hearing about what they're dealing with, and, you know, getting them on board and let's team up and get things done. Let's get things changed.
And when is your vote? Is it November of next year? Okay, June 15th. Nice.
Let's fast forward. Let's say that everything goes perfect and we're 8 years down the road because it's 2 4-year terms, correct? If I'm what does success look like for you? If we're standing here right now talking 8 years from now and you're getting ready to
be done, turn them out, what does that goals look like? That are more specific because that's what I'm all about is getting, you know, being very specific about my goals. I don't have them in front of me. I just kind of gamed it up and kind of put it in my book. But, you know, ultimately, I want to be the most resilient state in the country. I think we can have more fortified homes, more fortified businesses, wildfire prep communities. That is my absolute number one. I mean, I want fortified roofing to be Oklahoma. That's our standard. Oklahoma standards, fortified roofing. And so when those tornadoes, it's not necessarily tornadoes, just those, you know, we get those straight line winds and the hail. If we're resistant to that, we're going to have big time success with our premiums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's number one. And then number two, I want to regain that mitigation mindset of where we are risk management, right? We're reducing the risk before it happens. And that's in everything. I want to see our, you know, 8 years, that's past 2030. I want to see traffic deaths down 30%. I mean, you're talking about, so I want to I'm partnering with Institute for Highway Safety. They have a goal, reduce traffic deaths 30% by 2030. And they have specific things that you can do to do that. And I want to make sure, I want Oklahoma to be there. I mean, I've lost lots of people to traffic accidents, and I want to see that reduced. And that's, to me, it's mitigation, right? We're reducing traffic accidents, we're lowering costs, therefore you have lower auto premium costs. And so, you know, those are a couple of things that I really want to be after. But the resiliency and the mitigation, massively important.
This is a controversial thing for me, but to say, but I think that as technology keeps improving, there should be a way to turn cell phones off once you're in a car. You can only receive phone calls and make phone calls. There should be no text messages, no anything else can pop up. It's just phone calls only to kind of help drive down the distractions. Because you have, I see it when I'm taking some of my son's friends around, like, hey, where do you live? I don't know. Well, how do you get your house? I don't know. Like our boys, they can get home from wherever they are because we just, you know, we think it was important to have your head up and be looking and paying attention. I think there's too many kids now that don't pay enough attention.
Yeah.
And as they're becoming driving age, lock it down. Like, listen, you can't talk on your, all you can do is talk on your phone and almost a point where, you know, you're probably almost need to be an age where you can't talk on your phone while you're driving. If you're 16, under 18, you need to not, you know, no phone calls. If you want to make a phone call, pull off the side of the road, make your phone call and get back on, say, you know, be safe. Don't do anything silly. And I know it's somewhat controversial. But I think it's a public safety issue.
Yeah,
there's too many distracted drivers on the road.
Or, yeah, let's go back to flip phones. It's the best thing ever. That's my thought. But I get, that's the reaction I get every time.
My kids would die if they had to do a flip phone and not have an iPhone. I think they think that's end of the world.
99.9% of the population would die.
First world problem.
Yeah.
If they had a flip phone.
Pushing two. Yeah. Pushing the number two three times to get to letter C. Yeah, that'd be hard.
Exactly. But in reality, flip phones never had a problem with them.
You're right.
Now, they couldn't do 95% of the stuff that you can do now.
That's it.
Never had a problem.
My battery is starting up. It's going to go. It's going to slow if I run out. So just FYI.
Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up right here, Chris. We appreciate you being on the podcast with us and sharing your story of who you are and what you want to accomplish when you become insurance commissioner. We appreciate your time. Everybody, we appreciate you listening to our podcast. You can find all our podcasts anywhere your podcasts are found. We appreciate everything you guys do in making this so much fun for us that we get to have fun and talk to people and get to meet people and spend time learning about them. Until next time, we hope you guys have a great
day. So just go to social media.
Where can people find you, Chris?
Chris Meredith for Oklahoma.com.
Perfect.
All right.
See y'all.
All right. Until next time, everybody, have a great day.